Welcome back. You're listening to Policy and Pino, an ongoing discussion series on Rhode Island Public Radio in concert with the beautiful Providence Athenaeum. Joining me is Scott McKay, Maureen Moakley, and Pablo Rodriguez, and we're talking about the Rhode Island's 2014 election. Before we return to the other state general offices, let's switch gears to talk about the General Assembly and the raid by state and federal agents that triggered the resignation of House Speaker Gordon Fox back in March. Scott McKay, that raid was almost 2 months ago, and we've yet to get an official explanation of what triggered it. What do we know about why this happened?
Well, we think we know that this involved some conversion, probably of campaign money, for private use. But we don't know anything definitive, so I'm not going to go out on too much of a limb. You'll remember one thing you have to understand about politics is at the State House, the walls talk. At the U.S. Attorney's Office, no one does. They really like to undertake these things with discretion. They don't like pretrial publicity. They don't want to cause a mistrial. We saw the last time with Jim Terracani at Channel 10, the tape of Frank Correnti taking the $1,000 bribe getting out. We saw evidence being actually tampered with by one of the prosecutors who took that tape home and showed it to some friends of his who were lawyers. And the judge wasn't too happy about that. In fact, they're lucky that the case held up. Also, you have to remember, and Ian and I were talking about this the other day, it took 23 months after the FBI raided City Hall for them to indict Vincent A. Buddy Cianci Jr. So they're very deliberate. They're gathering evidence. They are not going to jump to any conclusions here. But the fact that the IRS was involved should be a hint that there's something going on with public funds and either not reporting or converting it to private use.
Maureen Moakley, we know you had some at least initial concerns about what struck you as kind of a high-handed way in which law enforcement caused a big stir by going into the State House. Do you still feel that way? And what are your takeaways on this investigation almost 2 months on?
I still hold to the point that it better be big, because to go into the State House and break into the Speaker's office should suggest that there were some significant transgressions that they were looking about. The thing here is that I think as it plays out, we're coming to understand that this is, first of all, it's about federal money also. And I think it also has to do with the Providence Economic Development Partnership. So you've got the feds involved, as well as taxes, as well as problems with campaign funds. And as we hear more about some of the directions that this is taking, my take might be that Gordon Fox is not necessarily at the center of this. He's a piece of it. But the fact is that I think there are other people that were probably more directly involved, or at least as involved, but we won't know, and we won't know for quite some time. So I think it's a fairly complicated thing, and the speculation is fantastic. But the bottom line is we don't really know what they're up to.
Pablo Rodriguez, how are you reading the tea leaves on the investigation that precipitated Speaker Fox's fall and where this investigation is headed?
Listen, diverting campaign funds for personal use is a Rhode Island tradition. So it's hard for me to believe that we are going to raid the State House for the first time to look at something that a lot of people are doing. We have so many legislators that have not filed their campaign reports because they can't, because they have used the money. That's why. And it's hard for me to believe that such a minor infraction would be the reason for a raid. I think there's federal money involved. I think the Providence Economic Development Corporation probably is involved. And I think 38 Studios could potentially be involved. When you are talking about bonds that are being sold to investors based on certain reassurances, it is possible that this also has to do with the investigation.
Gordon Fox's resignation as Speaker precipitated a weekend power struggle in which Nicholas Mattiello, who had been the number two official in the Rhode Island House, emerged as the next Speaker. He beat Michael Marcello, a representative from Coventry, who is perceived as more liberal. Mattiello has pledged to pursue a centrist, business-oriented course, and he called a quick vote on abolishing the master lever. What difference has Nick Mattiello made as Speaker, Maureen Moakley?
Well, I think it's fair to say that business has won the day. There's always been an argument about how do you accommodate business, because that's how you create jobs and you give them tax breaks and that creates more business and then you collect taxes. There's always a debate of whether or not it works. But right now, given Nicholas Mattiello and his focus on jobs and his focus on cutting corporate taxes, looking at the estate taxes and the continuing discussion about state taxes, I agree with Pablo. I mean, I don't see how we can cut taxes, but nonetheless, I think we're on that path. And so there will certainly be some tax cuts out of this session, I think. How far they go, I don't think they're going to get as far as the sales tax. I hope not until we figure out how we're going to make up that money. But I do think to placate the corporate community and to talk about how we are investing in jobs and doing something about unemployment, we're going to see some tax cuts along the corporate tax and estate tax line.
Pablo Rodriguez, we could probably agree that claims that Gordon Fox was kind of some kind of uber liberal were probably overstated, given how you cannot really govern from the extremes in the leadership of the General Assembly. But from where you sit, what kind of difference has Nicholas Mattiello made as Speaker?
Well, I can safely say that Fox has been the most liberal Speaker of the House that we've had. And In my opinion, I mean, I'm afraid as a community advocate, as a physician, for specifically for social services. If you are going to keep the promises of cutting these taxes, there's only one place where you can cut. And that is social services, that is Medicaid, that is welfare, that is aid for families with dependent children. All these services that are really vital at this point in the recession are at risk when you make these promises of cutting taxes that will not pay off immediately. These are long-term effect cuts. So if you cut taxes today, you're not going to see an immediate increase in the revenues to the state. It's going to take 2 or 3 years for this to happen. In the meantime, a lot of people are going to suffer.
Scott McKay, as we know, the norm of legislative leadership up on Smith Hill is somewhat socially conservative Democrats. So Pablo is absolutely right to call Gordon Fox a more liberal branch of that. But what are you seeing from Nick Mattiello?
I think he's setting a different tone, a little more pro-business. But, you know, he's only been there a couple of months, so I don't think we should rip him one way or another. I think he needs some time to get his team together and see just what he can do. He's got a tough budget to deal with. He's got a lame duck governor. It's not going to be an easy year. However, there's another place you can cut. You can cut education. I mean, 66% of the budget is in social services or education, both K-12 and higher education. If you look back at what Don Cachiri and the legislature did in the old days, they slashed the budget for higher ed and they cut taxes for the wealthy. Now, how did that work out for the economy? If you look at what Massachusetts did much differently during the recession, Deval Patrick and their general court, their legislature, raised the sales tax by 1.25% and invested that money in infrastructure, cities and towns, and education. And as a result, they have a much better educated workforce than Rhode Island does. They have a substantially lower unemployment rate, and their infrastructure spending is better. Their transportation rose, and we just didn't take that course, and we probably should have.
Now, 38 Studios is the new Rodan gift that keeps on giving. Just when we thought it was more dormant as an issue, it comes racing back. Governor Chafee has included about $12.5 million in his budget proposal for paying back 38 Studios bondholders. And there's now a very full-blooded debate about whether or not it makes sense to pay back these bondholders. Governor Chafee, Treasurer Raimondo, some other officials say that not paying back the bondholders would hurt Rodan's reputation and credit. And other public officials like Alan Fung and Ken Block say that defaulting or not paying the money is the right way to go. What do you say, Pablo Rodriguez?
Listen, I have a hard time understanding how is it that very intelligent people would think that a downgrade of the bonds that has been threatened already by the rating agencies is not going to affect us. That it's not going to be a big deal. We live at a time when investments are moving at the speed of light.
And yet these are moral obligation bonds in which the investors were told they could lose all their money and the state would be under no obligation to repay them.
The the people that are investing from Tuscaloosa, from California, from Germany, don't have that kind of detail. They know the grade of the bonds. These are the grades. If the grades are down, I'm not going to buy them. I'm going to sell them. So we are going to experience an increase in the cost of business, an increase in the cost of our borrowing as a result of something that we have the moral obligation to pay. The rating agencies are already telling us that they will downgrade and we'll have accelerated payments for the bonds that we just took out for the 195 construction. So this is really a big deal and a big decision for the legislature to make.
Well, Pablo, I don't know if it was the people in Tuscaloosa who were buying these 38 studios bonds, but let's go to Maureen Moakley here. Maureen, Speaker Mattiello has among his leadership team some of the sharpest critics of paying back the 38 studios bonds, and he's been kind of taking a wait-and-see approach. What is your view of where this issue of repaying the 38 studios bonds is headed?
Look, I'm inclined to agree with Pablo. I mean, I think one of the other points that the governor makes, and here I agree with the governor, is we are in the middle of trying to recoup some of this money in a very complicated lawsuit. And to pull the rug out now and say, well, we're not going to pay it back, I think it only adds to the conflict and only adds to our sort of faulty reputation. It's interesting to me that this has come down on partisan lines insofar as the three Democratic candidates are saying, we've got to pay it back, and the Republicans are saying no. I think that the legislature is in a bind. I think in the short term, they certainly have to pay the $12 million that they've scheduled and then see how this plays out. And my sense, as far as Mattiello is concerned, given where the Democrats stand on this, my sense is he'll go that far, in other words, and sort of push it off and revisit it after we find out, for example, what happens in the criminal case and particularly what happens in the civil case. Then there might be a chance to revisit this.
Scott McKay, you were far-sighted in perceiving 38 Studios as a boondoggle. And as you have noted many times, former Republican Governor Don Carcheri was a champion of the project. But doesn't Lincoln Chafee bear some blame for not really closely monitoring what was happening with 38 Studios after he came into office?
There's been some spin on that, but I don't really buy it because he had nothing to do. If he had gone in there and micromanaged it, he would have been criticized for that. The deal was pretty much set in stone, and the thing blew up shortly after he took over as governor.
Scott, now, what do you make of this noise from Standard and Poor's and other rating agencies that it will be very adverse for Rodon not to pay back these bonds? Is this just Wall Street flapping its power, or do you take that as a credible threat?
Here's what I'm interested in. We just refinanced a big chunk of bonds, okay? They were originally 4.3% interest. The state got a fabulous rate, 2.2%. It just closed on Tuesday. I think they were rated AA. Now, do you think if we don't pay those obligations that we're going to get that 2.2% rate from Wall Street? No, we're not. We're not California. We're Rhode Island. Yeah. We don't have that much clout in the marketplace, and people just have to understand that. We have to bite our lips, and this is the fault of the General Assembly. They had 3 years to figure this out. Not a word. All they tried to do was sweep this whole thing under those maroon rugs up there in the House and Senate lounge. When the banking crisis happened, you'll remember the Tights Commission that looked into it, that had subpoenas, interviewed people under oath. And, you know, we just didn't do any of that this time. So now at the last minute before the session ends, we're going to try to figure this out.
Maureen Moakley, did you have a final word on that question?
Yeah, I want to disagree with you on that. I think the idea that we have a criminal investigation, we have a very detailed civil trial, and the idea of citizen legislators now subpoenaing individuals and trying to figure out how we got into this mess when we still don't even know all the facts, I think would be imprudent at this point. And also, I think the governor did the right thing in the sense that he was against this from the beginning. And the reason why he was criticized at the end, if you remember, is he was criticizing it and they were saying, oh, you're going to affect the market. Keep quiet. So he was in a tough position, and I think he did everything he could do.
Back here in the capital city of Providence, the race to replace Angel Taveras as mayor is heating up. With Taveras running for governor, there are five Democrats seeking to replace him. Those include City Council President Michael Solomon, Roger Williams Law School Professor Jorge Lorza, consultant and lobbyist Brett Smiley, businessman Lorne Adrian, and perennial candidate Christopher Young. Daniel Harrop is the Republican candidate. And meanwhile, there's speculation that the once and perhaps future prince of Providence, Buddy Cianci, will throw his hat into the ring. Scott McKay, what is your read on this race?
This is a huge frittata. Now, for reporters, this race is the gift that keeps on giving. Cianci has Joe Paolino out there. He's got a lot of people, his intimates out there telling people he's going to run, he's going to do it. He's got a tough decision to make. Does he run as an independent, which guarantees he gets to the general, or does he get into a 5 or 6 way Democratic primary where he can win with 28, 29, 30% of the vote like he did in his comeback in 1990. So it's going to be really fascinating. There's also the definite fact, we all know that this may be an elaborate ruse, that he may be doing this and ginning all this up so he can go to the last day and boost the ratings for his talk show. So he's unpredictable guy. He's also sick. He's had cancer. He's being treated for cancer. So it's going to be fascinating. But he does hold the key to just what this election is going to be like.
Pablo Rodriguez is the idea of Buddy Cianci staging his latest comeback at age 73, an elaborate ruse.
I think it's an elaborate ruse. I think that, you know, he is having too much fun at this point. No, really, seriously. As a talk show host on television, everybody's looking for him now. I mean, when he left City Hall, you know, he was a pariah. Nobody wanted to touch him. Now he's a popular guy again. If he becomes a politician, you know, he's going to lose all that, all those fans that he has now on the radio and on television.
What do you say, Maureen Moakley?
I think just to add to that, I tend to agree, because he probably could win. It would be wonderful if he was running in a 5-way primary. He's only got to get 24% of the vote. But I don't think he can win in a general election in a 2-way race. I don't think there's enough people that would vote for him.
And if he wins, then he has to go to work.
Yeah, and then, so in that sense, I agree with my colleagues here.
Very quickly, give us a Michael Solomon, the city council president, got out early by raising money and signing up supporters. How does he look compared to the other candidates? Scott McKay.
I think that Mike Solomon is the leader in the clubhouse at this point, mainly because he's worked very well with Mayor Taveras, and they both took over a city that was in serious trouble. He really worked well with the mayor, and he's raised a lot of money. The other thing, however, a lot of holes to be played, and it's very early in this thing. I'd say it's basically spring training in the mayor's race.
Okay, let's go to Maureen Moakley.
Well, I also agree, and I think that the other person that has some potential, and every time I was with Jorge Loza, every time someone else gets into the race, his eyes pick up, because he does have a base, and he's got a strong ethnic ties. So, you know, in a 5-way race, it's not out of the question that that advantages him. What do you think, Pablo?
Well, I think that Solomon has done a tremendous job about working the Latino base. He has almost every Latino politician in Providence in his camp. Actually, I see Jorge almost as an east side candidate. I mean, he's got a lot of support on the east side and in the south side as well. So,
among the
Latino community. The symbol of having a Latino mayor is something that is very, very strong and powerful.
The funniest thing is the fulcrum to victory in Providence mayoral races for the last 3 or 4 elections has been the east side. And right now, the east side is all cut up. And so there's no one candidate of the east side.
We're going to take a quick break. Coming up, a look at the races for Attorney General, Treasurer, Secretary of State, and Lieutenant Governor. I'm Ian Donis. You're listening to Policy and Pino on Rodan Public Radio. It's the Political Roundtable edition looking at Rodan's 2014 election season. And we're recording in front of a live audience here at the Providence Athenaeum.